thick blue carpets on the floor, blue and green fabrics hiding the rock walls, glow globes tuned to yellow overhead, bobbing against draped yellow ceiling fabrics. The effect was that of an ancient tent. Hara stood in front of him, left hand on hip, her eyes studying his face.
"The children are with a friend," she said. "They will present themselves later."
Paul masked his unease beneath a quick scanning of the room. Thin hangings to the right, he saw, partly concealed a larger room with cushions piled around the walls. He felt a soft breeze from an air duct, saw the outlet cunningly hidden in a pattern of hangings directly ahead of him.
"Do you wish me to help you remove your still suit?" Hara asked.
"No, thank you."
"Shall I bring food?"
"Yes."
"There is a reclamation chamber off the other room,"
she gestured,
"for your comfort and convenience when you're out of your stillsuit."
"You said we have to leave this siege," Paul said. "Shouldn't we be packing or something?"
"It will be done in its time," she said. "The butchers have yet to penetrate to our region."
Still, she hesitated, staring at him. "What is it?" he demanded.
"You've not the eyes of the Ibad," she said. "It's strange, but not entirely unattractive."
"Get the food," he said. "I'm hungry." She smiled at him, a knowing woman's smile that he found disquieting.
"I am your servant," she said,
and whirled away in one lithe motion, ducking behind a heavy wall hanging that revealed another passage before falling back into place. Feeling angry with himself, Paul brushed through the thin hanging on the right and into the larger room. He stood there a moment, caught by uncertainty, and he wondered where Chani was. Chani, who had just lost her father. "We're alike in that," he thought. A wailing cry sounded from the outer corridors, its volume muffled by the intervening hangings. It was repeated, a bit more distant, and again. Paul realized someone was calling the time. He focused on the fact that he had seen no clocks. The faint smell of burning creosote bush came to his nostrils, riding on the omnipresent stink of the siege. Paul saw that he had already suppressed the odorous assault on his senses. And he wondered again about his mother, how the moving montage of the future would incorporate her, and the daughter she bore. Mutable time awareness danced around him. He shook his head sharply, focusing his attention on the evidences that spoke of profound depth and breadth in this Fremen culture that had swallowed them, with its subtle oddities. He had seen a thing about the caverns and this room, a thing that suggested far greater differences than anything he had yet encountered. There was no sign of a poison snooper here, no indication of their use anywhere in the cave warren. Yet he could smell poisons in the siege stench, strong ones, common ones. He heard a rustle of hangings, thought it was Hara returning with food, and turned to watch her. Instead, from beneath a displaced pattern of hangings, he saw two young boys, perhaps aged 9 and 10, staring out at him with greedy eyes. Each wore a small kinjal type of kris knife, rested a hand on the hilt. And Paul recalled the stories of the Fremen, that their children fought as ferociously as the adults.
"The hands move, the lips move, ideas gush from his words, and his eyes devour. He is an island of selfdom."
Description from A Manual of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. Phosphor tubes in the faraway upper reaches of the cavern cast a dim light onto the thronged interior, hinting at the great size of this rock-enclosed space, larger, Jessica saw, than even the gathering hall of her Bene Gesserit school. She estimated there were more than 5,000 people gathered out there beneath the ledge where she stood with Stilgar, and more were coming. The air was murmurous with people.
"Your son has been summoned from his rest, Sayadina," Stilgar said. "Do you wish him to share in your decision?"
"Could he change my decision?"
"Certainly. The air with which you speak comes from your own lungs, but..."
"The decision stands," she said.
But she felt misgivings, wondering if she should use Paul as an excuse for backing out of a dangerous course. There was an unborn daughter to think of as well. What endangered the flesh of the mother endangered the flesh of the daughter. Men came with rolled carpets, grunting under the weight of them, stirring up dust as the loads were dropped onto the ledge. Stilgar took her arm, led her back into the acoustical horn that formed the rear limits of the ledge. He indicated a rock bench within the horn.
"The Reverend Mother will sit here, but you may rest yourself until she comes."
"I prefer to stand," Jessica said.
She watched the men unroll the carpets, covering the ledge, looked out at the crowd. There were at least 10,000 people on the rock floor now, and still they came. Out on the desert, she knew, it already was red nightfall. but here in the cavern hall was perpetual twilight, a gray vastness thronged with people come to see her risk her life. A way was opened through the crowd to her right, and she saw Paul approaching, flanked by two small boys. There was a swaggering air of self-importance about the children. They kept hands on knives, scowled at the wall of people on either side.
"The sons of Jameis, who are now the sons of Usul," Stilgar said. "They take their escort duties seriously."
He ventured a smile at Jessica. Jessica recognized the effort to lighten her mood, and was grateful for it, but could not take her mind from the danger that confronted her.
"I had no choice but to do this," she thought. "We must move swiftly if we're to secure our place among these Fremen."
Paul climbed to the ledge, leaving the children below. He stopped in front of his mother, glanced at Stilgar, back to Jessica.
"What is happening? I thought I was being summoned to council."
Stilgar raised a hand for silence, gestured to his left where another way had been opened in the throng. Chani came down the lane opened there, her elfin face set in lines of grief. She had removed her stillsuit and wore a graceful blue wraparound that exposed her thin arms. Near the shoulder on her left arm, a green kerchief had been tied.
"Green for mourning," Paul thought.
It was one of the customs the two sons of Jameis had explained to him by indirection, telling him they wore no green because they accepted him as guardian father.
"Are you the Lizan al-Ghaib?" they had asked,
and Paul had sensed the jihad in their words, shrugged off the question with one of his own, learning then that Calef, the elder of the two, was 10, and the natural son of Jeff. Orlop, the younger, was 8, the natural son of Jameis. It had been a strange day with these two standing guard over him because he asked it, keeping away the curious, allowing him the time to nurse his thoughts and prescient memories, to plan a way to prevent the jihad. Now, standing beside his mother on the cavern ledge, and looking out at the throng, he wondered if any plan could prevent the wild outpouring of fanatic legions. Chani, nearing the ledge, was followed at a distance by 4 women carrying another woman in a litter. Jessica ignored Chani's approach, focusing all her attention on the woman in the litter, a crone, a wrinkled and shriveled ancient thing in a black gown with hood thrown back to reveal the tight knot of gray hair and the stringy neck. The litter carriers deposited their burden gently on the ledge from below, and Chani helped the old woman to her feet.
"So this is their reverend mother," Jessica thought.
The old woman leaned heavily on Chani as she hobbled toward Jessica, looking like a collection of sticks draped in the black robe. She stopped in front of Jessica, peered upward for a long moment before speaking in a husky whisper.
"So you're the one."
The old head nodded once precariously on the thin neck.
"The Shaddat Mapes was right to pity you."
Jessica spoke quickly, scornfully.
"I need no one's pity."
"That remains to be seen,"
husked the old woman. She turned with surprising quickness and faced the throng.
"Tell them, Stilgar."
"Must I?" he asked.
"We are the people of Mysore," the old woman rasped. "Since our Sunni ancestors fled from Nilotic al-Arub, we have known flight and death. The young go on, that our people shall not die."
Stilgar took a deep breath, stepped forward 2 paces. Jessica felt the hush come over the crowded cavern. Some 20,000 people now, standing silently, almost without movement. It made her feel suddenly small and filled with caution.
"Tonight we must leave this siege that has sheltered us for so long and go south into the desert," Stilgar said.
His voice boomed out across the uplifted faces, reverberating with the force given it by the acoustical horn behind the ledge. Still, the throng remained silent.
"The Reverend Mother tells me she cannot survive another Hajra," Stilgar said. "We have lived before without a Reverend Mother, but it is not good for people to seek a new home in such straits."
Now the throng stirred, rippling with whispers and currents of disquiet.
"That this may not come to pass," Stilgar said, "our new Sayadina, Jessica of the Weirding, has consented to enter the rite at this time. She will attempt to pass within, that we not lose the strength of our Reverend Mother."
Jessica of the Weirding, Jessica thought.
She saw Paul staring at her, his eyes filled with questions, but his mouth held silent by all the strangeness around them.
"If I die in the attempt, what will become of him?" Jessica asked herself.
Again she felt the misgivings fill her mind. Chani led the old Reverend Mother to a rock bench deep in the acoustical horn, returned to stand beside Stilgar.
"That we may not lose all if Jessica of the Weirding should fail," Stilgar said, "Chani, daughter of Liet, will be consecrated in the Sayadina at this time."
He stepped 1 pace to the side. From deep in the acoustical horn, the old woman's voice came out to them, an amplified whisper, harsh and penetrating.
Chani has returned from her hajra. Chani has seen the waters.
A susurrant response arose from the crowd.
She has seen the waters.
I consecrate the daughter of Liet in the Sayadina,
husked the old woman.
She is accepted, the crowd responded.
Paul barely heard the ceremony, his attention still centered on what had been said of his mother. If she should fail? He turned and looked back at the one they called Reverend Mother, studying the dried crone features, the fathomless blue fixation of her eyes. She looked as though a breeze would blow her away, yet there was that about her which suggested she might stand untouched in the path of a Coriolis storm. She carried the same aura of power that he remembered from the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, who had tested him with agony in the way of the Gam Jabbar.
I, the Reverend Mother Romalo, whose voice speaks as a multitude, say this to you,
the old woman said.
It is fitting that Chani enter the Sayadina.
It is fitting, the crowd responded.
The old woman nodded, whispered,
I give her the silver skies, the golden desert and its shining rocks, the green fields that will be. I give these to Sayadina Chani. And lest she forget that she's servant of us all, to her fall the menial tasks in this ceremony of the seed. Let it be as Shai Hulud will have it.
She lifted a brown stick arm, dropped it. Jessica, feeling the ceremony close around her with a current that swept her beyond all turning back, glanced once at Paul's question-filled face, then prepared herself for the ordeal.
Let the water masters come forward,
Chani said, with only the slightest quaver of uncertainty in her girl-child voice. Now, Jessica felt herself at the focus of danger, knowing its presence in the watchfulness of the throng, in the silence. A band of men made its way through a serpentine path opened in the crowd, moving up from the back in pairs. Each pair carried a small skin sack, perhaps twice the size of a human head. The sacks sloshed heavily. The two leaders deposited their load at Chani's feet on the ledge and stepped back. Jessica looked at the sack, then at the men. They had their hoods thrown back, exposing long hair tied in a roll at the base of the neck. The black pits of their eyes stared back at her without wavering. A furry redolence of cinnamon arose from the sack, wafted across Jessica.
The spice? She wondered. Is there water?
Chani asked. The watermaster on the left, a man with a purple scar line across the bridge of his nose, nodded once.
There is water, Sayadina, he said, but we cannot drink of it.
Is there seed?
Chani asked.
There is seed, the man said.
Chani knelt and put her hands to the sloshing sack.
Blessed is the water and its seed.
There was familiarity to the rite, and Jessica looked back at the Reverend Mother Romalo. The old woman's eyes were closed, and she sat hunched over as though asleep.
Sayadina Jessica,
Chani said. Jessica turned to see the girl staring up at her.
Have you tasted the blessed water?
Chani asked. Before Jessica could answer, Chani said,
It is not possible that you have tasted the blessed water. You are outworlder and unprivileged.
A sigh passed through the crowd, a susurration of robes that made the nape hairs creep on Jessica's neck.
The crop was large, and the maker has been destroyed,
Chani said. She began unfastening a coiled spout fixed to the top of the sloshing sack. Now, Jessica felt the sense of danger boiling around her. She glanced at Paul, saw that he was caught up in the mystery of the ritual, and had eyes only for Chani.
Has he seen this moment in time?
Jessica wondered. She rested a hand on her abdomen, thinking of the unborn daughter there, asking herself,
Do I have the right to risk us both?
Chani lifted the spout toward Jessica, said,
Here is the water of life, the water that is greater than water. Khan, the water that frees the soul. If you be a reverend mother, it opens the universe to you. Let Shai Hulud judge now.
Jessica felt herself torn between duty to her unborn child and duty to Paul. For Paul, she knew, she should take that spout and drink of the sack's contents. But as she bent to the proffered spout, her senses told her its peril. The stuff in the sack had a bitter smell subtly akin to many poisons that she knew, but unlike them, too.
You must drink it now,
Chani said.
There's no turning back,
Jessica reminded herself. But nothing in all her Bene Gesserit training came into her mind to help her through this instant.
What is it?
Jessica asked herself.
Liquor? A drug?
She bent over the spout, smelled the esters of cinnamon, remembering then the drunkenness of Duncan Idaho.
Spice liquor?
she asked herself. She took the siphon tube in her mouth, pulled up only the most minuscule sip. It tasted of the spice, a faint bite acrid on the tongue. Chani pressed down on the skin bag. A great gulp of the stuff surged into Jessica's mouth, and before she could help herself, she swallowed it, fighting to retain her calmness and dignity.